I would like to thank the Turrbal people who have allowed us to meet here in Meanjin, the sacred country of their ancestors. I would like to acknowledge the courage, encouragement and teaching of many Aboriginal people, in particular Anne Patel Gray, Auntie Nola Kerr and Auntie Wadjalabina Nulyarima, and my friend David Carline. I also want to acknowledge the loving and sometimes stern promptings of my Quaker elder, Lloyd Williams. A host of spirits offer their protection and guidance to us. As we greet these spirits, let us also welcome our own ancestral spirits who have brought us together tonight. And in acknowledging them, we greet all that has been part of our journey through the many dimensions of the universe since the beginnings of matter and time. The earth, ground of our being. The waters of the rains, oceans, rivers and lakes, and of our own bodies. The moving air in whom we live and move. And the sun, great fireball, giver of life and light. Greetings too to the more than human world, both known and unknown to us, all who share this earth with us. From our familiars, the forests, bright birds, great beasts, close domestics, and symbols of wilderness, to those whose misunderstood presence we often fear, the reptiles, mosquitoes, cockroaches and spiders, bacteria and viruses, the earthquakes and hurricanes, floods and raging fires. All are gathered in the spirit with us. For whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there thy hand shall lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me fast. Indeed, the Spirit is everywhere. Seven years ago, Janie O'Shea delivered her backhouse lecture here in Brisbane. And the most vivid memory I have of that occasion were not the words that Janie spoke, but the presence of her foster fruit bats. I realised how powerfully the spirit of her charges had inspired her lecture when I later read her words. In the topsy-turvy world of the way of God, as taught by Jesus, familiar categories turn upside down. Living upside down in the right side up world, we are asked to be and to do many things seemingly beyond human wisdom or power. But if we are open to the spirit, the signs of our times and our Quaker heritage, we will find new and unexpected places to give the fertility needed by the world, taking our own nourishment at the same time. I would like to talk tonight about what may, for many, be one such new or unexpected place. When I was asked to prepare a lecture about friends and the natural environment, I found it impossible to do so without considering environmental issues and issues of Aboriginal justice as indivisibly interrelated areas of concern. I feel it is vital that in moving toward real reconciliation, we recognise that the harm we do to this earth, we do instantly and directly to Aboriginal peoples, and that what has been and continues to be done to the Aboriginal peoples intimately affects these lands. Quakers often self-identify as a people called to wait on the Spirit and to act on that Spirit's promptings of love and truth. Although we are called to be in the world while not of it, it is always true that the culture of the Society of Friends also reflects to some extent the culture of its secular settings. Establishing a functioning, realistic balance is claimed to be the necessary tension of life as a friend. Being present where we are is a familiar Quaker phrase to describe the starting point of discerning the Spirit's leadings. And I use this as a benchmark to reflect on the history of Friends in Australia as I prepared this lecture. It was then that I began to realise that rather than suffer being present where we are, we may perhaps have constructed a culture of benevolent superiority to shield us from the uncomfortable truths of theft, genocide, and environmental devastation, and may unconsciously have tailored our perception of the Spirit accordingly. Tonight I want to look at some of the consequences of this cultural limitation of the Spirit, in particular those which affect our relationship with the Aboriginal peoples and with their lands. I would like us to consider that in our balancing act between the Spirit and the secularity of the world, we may have failed to honour the spirituality of the Aboriginal peoples, because we have been hesitant about acknowledging the Spirit in the more than human world of nature. I'd like then to conclude by looking at some of the ways in which we may begin to invite a more inclusive Spirit into our meetings for worship and into our lives as individual Quakers. I'm convinced that a fresh and open heeding of the Spirit's promptings has the potential to guide us towards real reconciliation with Aboriginal peoples and with the whole of creation, so that our witness to that of God in all may indeed give the fertility needed by the world, as well as nourish us with the spiritual food we hunger for. To begin, I'd like to share a personal story with you so that you know where I'm coming from. One night, about 30 years ago, I was camped in the rugged spinifex-clad hills in Kalkadoon country. I was familiar with the sound of stone curlews, but on this occasion, their wailing cries under the full moon made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Theirs was a voice and a message that I had to heed. I knew something terrible had happened there. When I got back to Mount Isa, I asked the locals and my mining acquaintances about the place. I learnt that unknowingly I'd been camped at the site of a massacre of the Kalkadoon warriors by the armed stockmen of Alexander Kennedy, the pastoralist. The locals threw in a bit of extra information and proudly told me that within living memory, one of the area's founding mothers had made baths of poisoned bread, which successfully cleaned up the Kalkadoon women and children. Even after I moved to a hamlet on the Atherton Tablelands, the horror of what had happened to the Kalkadoon people weighed heavily on me. How could I not acknowledge the old man who sat on the steps of the co-op store waiting for the chance of an odd, menial job? Things were fine as long as Stanley was sober. But when he was drunk, it was quite terrible. He would call me Mrs., obsequiously beg my pardon and ask my forgiveness. My shame did not know where to hide itself. One evening, after it was dark and the kerosene lamp had been lit, a discreet clearing of the throat alerted me to a surprise visit. At a distance from the doorway stood Stanley, with Charlie, another Aboriginal man I had occasionally seen up the street. Their wetted hair had been combed back into glistening crinkles, and they wore shoes and black suits, the special occasion clothes I have since come to associate with Aboriginal funerals. As Stanley and Charlie sat with us, they began quietly to tell us where they were born, of their kinship with each other through their people's kinship system, and of the animals and plants that were sacred to them, the ones that they could kill for food and those that were taboo. I think I will never forget the atmosphere of reverence and respect that seemed to develop in the half-lit room. It was my first experience of something involving human beings that could be called sacred. However, it was not until an experience, 20 years ago now, an experience of the spirit in all lifted me into the shining reality of my intimate relatedness with every blade of grass, every drop of autumn dew on every leaf tip, that I began to contemplate the experience of what might be called the divine. Light radiated from each shrub and tree. Everything knew me, and I was part of everything. I would not call it oneness, because everything was so distinctly different and its own self. Yet all of us were kin by virtue of what I could only then call God. No, I hadn't eaten any funny mushrooms. It just happened one morning when I was walking alone in the bush. Although I had always felt at home and accepted in the bush, this was my road to Damascus experience. Like Paul, I too soon regained my normal vision, but the cataclysmic nature of what happened has shaped every conscious moment of my life from then on. Divine kinship of this sort calls instantly for community, as anyone who has experienced something like this will know. There is a sense in which one recognises that what has happened is not for oneself alone, but is fuel for one's life, to be used for the greater good of all. I knew of no church community which could accept my experience without imposing limitations, dogmas, and catechisms, so it was some time before I discovered Quakers. But when I read that George Fox's conversion had brought him into unity with the creation, and that he had come up in spirit through the flaming sword into the paradise of God, wherein all things were new, and all creation gave another smell than before, beyond what words can utter, it seemed that I'd found the community I yearned for. When I encountered Quakerism, I perceived it to be concerned with peace and justice and loving humanity and offering mutual spiritual support to those open to knowing the spirit experimentally. I read words about our oneness with all creation, and one of the advices encouraged friends to live simply and be gentle to nature. Among friends, I hoped to test the truth of my numinous experiences and discover the Quaker way of integrating them with action. But I found that while the Quaker spirit today encompasses a general and poetic sweep of nature, its interests are predominantly anthropocentric, that is, human-focused, and its concepts of beauty and virtue are defined by the comfortable urbanity of the discerning Western eclectic soul. For most friends, it seemed to me, that of God was reflected in a sort of hierarchy of being, with humanity at the top. The spirit, discerned as a still small voice, or felt in the promptings of love and truth in the human hearts, was to be best, even exclusively, experienced in the interhuman encounter. Apparently, the sensitivity urged by the advice about being gentle to nature was to be kept within the reasonable bounds of normal behaviour. I found that these reasonable bounds were often determined by the best wisdom of our secular, humanist, and scientifically rational world, as was, it also seemed, the character of the spirit itself. It was a spirit educated in the knowledge of Western science and the wisdom of modern psychology. A spirit who is sensitive to Eastern mysticism and to meditation techniques. A spirit with broad classicist understandings of the church mothers and fathers and their teachings about love. Inevitably, a humanist spirit with a good heart, prompting us to care for the poor and downcast, and seek to right wrongs. So what became of our oneness with all creation and that of God in all? It is clear that while not high on the Quaker agenda today, a unity with the creation, George Fox's words, remember, not only preceded but informed early friends' peace testimony as the basis for all their thought and behaviour. That's a quote. In the mid-17th century, mystic, political activist and proto-Quaker, perhaps better known to international socialists than to friends, Gerard Wynne Stanley, felt he could only know God through the physical senses, because we too are of the earth. He declared, "If you would know spiritual things, it is to know that the spirit of wisdom and life dwells with and governs both the several bodies of the stars and the planets in the heavens above, and the several bodies of the earth below, as grass, plants, fishes, beasts, birds, and mankind. For Wynne Stanley, the body of Christ is where the Father is, in the earth, purifying the earth. And his spirit is entered into the whole creation, which is the heavenly glory where the Father dwells." And James Naylor, once considered by some to be the leader among early friends, was prompted to declare that God is the life of every creature, though few there be that know it. But over time, Orthodox Quakerism has carefully distanced itself from such expressions of experience of the spirit. It was gradually impressed upon me that while friends saw nature as a powerful reminder of God's omnipresence and a useful trigger for spiritual renewal, ultimately the more than human world of existence was little more than a metaphor for the spiritual life, a mere backdrop to worship. I came to learn that for many friends, the very mention of the spirit in nature is the stuff of past heathenism and New Age fantasy. It may never occur to many of us that the spirit may also be found beyond the human sphere. This phenomenon was observed by John Coe, a former warden of the Melbourne Meeting House, in his poem about friends' relationship with a magnificent wattle tree that once shaded the car park. "A great shining bushel concealing a dark candle that illumines and shelters Godhead in its shade, that offers unconditional balm, solace, aid, to souls that pause and flinch from too much light, that crave the inner blessed holy sight. This silver green grey bower, drooping, drawing us in, has more power than all the household shrines and Marian scents, where we do pause and give some reverence. The advertisement for imminence is starkly plain, but still we pass each time and time again with no more than a perfunctory inward nod, then walk inside to look for God. It is hardly surprising, then, that this culturally limited, friendly spirit, although kindly and concerned, has not readily found compatibility with the spirit of this ancient, alien land, or with the spiritual understandings of its Aboriginal peoples. So it was that I began to realise it might be futile to yearn for meetings for worship within the community of life, so that all could share in the ministry of the rocks and trees and ants. With the human condition occupying the Quaker focus, I began to doubt that issues of the more than human sort that concerned me, like the devastation of the soils and forests and the vanishing of the animal species, would ever be thought worthy of a truly Quaker concern. To preserve my sense of belonging within the society, I tried to conceal my relationship with the spirit in nature. I also took seriously the advice to consider that I might be mistaken. And periodically, I tried to reason my experiences out of existence. 5 years ago, our friend David Carline of the Kuma Nation rescued me from my double life as proper public Quaker and secretive pagan. During a conversation about the likelihood of an Aboriginal person becoming a member of the Society of Friends, he affirms that my experiences in the bush were of Aboriginal spiritual origin, and that the spirits of the land had been caring for me. I experienced an instant of intense spiritual integration. No longer did I have to try to hide my experiences of the spirit in nature from friends. David's encouragement enabled me to begin speaking and writing my truth. This renewed confidence in my relationship with the spirit also ushered in a new clarity in my relationships with Aboriginal peoples, and I felt I began to know them in the things which are eternal. But this spirit is not the comfortable thought I can put in my pocket as a talisman against the rufflings of inner peace. While increasingly it opens the intricate glories of creation to me, it prizes open my eyes, cleans out my ears, and tears at my heart so that I will perceive what is happening in this land. It is a spirit that mercilessly shows me my part in the ongoing devastation of this country and the genocide of its peoples. It leads me to realise that any real reconciliation must address the issue of the spirituality of the more than human world, and that any awakening to the spirit in nature must include justice for Aboriginal peoples. It is a spirit whose presence I can hardly bear. I suspect it can be no other than the spirit of the flaming sword of truth and love and justice George Fox spoke of, the spirit that will kill us unless we obey its promptings. Illustrations of the cultural limitation of the spirit I'm talking about abound in the journals of James Backhouse and his companion, George Washington Walker, whose amazing peregrinations throughout Tasmania and the mainland of Australia constitute the founding fathers' legend for Australian friends. Backhouse tells of a visit to the Noonuccal people on Minjeriba or Stradbroke Island, where he witnesses some of their spiritual ceremonies. He considers these little more than boisterous child's play, though he concedes that many of the amusements practiced in circles of British society and considered highly civilised might seem as absurd. Elsewhere, Backhouse records that the Aboriginal peoples have scarcely any ideas of a deity and no religious law. he comforts himself with the knowledge that God will judge them only according to the measure of the light they have received. And he concludes thankfully that the Society of Friends has made great advances in true civilization beyond the rest of the world. It does seem as if the time had long since passed when one such as the American friend John Woolman could confess to being led by love to visit with Indigenous peoples, that he might feel and understand their life and the spirit they live in, if haply he might be instructed by them. To put our Quaker travellers into their historical perspective, let me give you a mini sketch of their times. The Briton of Backhouse and Walker had usurped a large proportion of the Earth's landmass to feed a burgeoning techno-science with a supposedly inexhaustible supply of cheap natural and human resources. The ruling god, domineering and transcendent, in whose omnipotent and omniscient image the white and especially English man was made, seemed to sanction and reinvigorate old prejudices. The new science was rapidly developing and about to blossom into social Darwinism. The white man's omnipresence could now be seen to be divinely justified in subduing the rest of creation, including its Aboriginal peoples, who were thought to be little more intelligent than monkeys. That's a quote from Banks, not Backhouse and Walker. At first, Backhouse and Walker seemed to stand apart from their culture. With their quiet mien and humble use of Shanks's pony, almost everywhere they journey to hold their meetings with convicts, temperance leaguers, Aborigines and governors, they are vignetted in Quaker mildness and innocent goodness. But when Backhouse, a respected botanist, returned home, his nursery business boomed as the demand for imported Australian plants grew. All his travels among Aboriginal peoples seemed to have left him unaware that the whole of the more than human environment is spiritually integral to Aboriginal relationships, and that to damage any part is to violate the whole. Walker wrote passionately that the Aborigines are the rightful owners of the soil and have had wholesale robbery of their territory committed upon them by the government, and that settlers have become the receivers of this stolen property, and that the British occupation involves the very extinction of the Aboriginal peoples. Strong words indeed. Yet being a Quaker did not preclude a certain mental block when it came to the issue of personal land ownership versus black land rights. Returning to Tasmania to live out his days as one of those very settlers, Walker seems not to have remembered the Quakerly example set by a South Australian attender, Robert Cock, in paying the rent to those rightful owners. Instead, Walker opened a bank and unconsciously became part of establishing the continuing culture of invasion and genocide. Now, some of you may be feeling that Backhouse and Walker should not be so unfairly judged by the understandings of our present age. It may seem a harsh introduction to those whose concern for Aboriginal peoples was genuine and whose labours with colonial powers on behalf of their welfare were heartfelt and vigorous. Others of you may be thinking gratefully that time has distanced ourselves from much more than Backhouse and Walker's obsession with temperance. Nonetheless, I suspect that to dismiss as a past phenomenon our friends' benevolent superiority towards those they saw as, quote, primitives, lacking any civilizing spirituality which they could learn from, unquote, is to evade the possibility that a similar unconscious attitude lies at the root of our priorities and behaviour today. After all, our Quaker witness to Aboriginal justice over the intervening years has scarcely been free of this sort of superior attitude. In scorning those for whom the whole of creation is the centre and source of all spirituality as heathen, superstitious and deluded, we implicitly deny the uniquely valid spiritual experiences of many thousands of years. Historically, the philosophy of such denial has opened the way for relentless violation of the earth, and what Wiradjuri poet and activist Kevin Gilbert referred to as the rape of the soul of its indigenous peoples. If we are truly moved towards real reconciliation via the Quaker way, we will need to look at what underpins our lives in this country, a country we have not yet been invited into. In the words of John Woolman, we shall need to try, that is, to examine, whether the seeds of war, that is, the injustices and destruction that surround us in this land, have nourishment in our way of life, in the comfort of our chosen surroundings, in the excitement of our preferred activities, and even, dare I say it, in the unspoken protocols of our own meetings for worship. Here is another story from the journals of Backhouse and Walker. Not many months after their encounter with the Noonuccal people, Backhouse and Walker found themselves camped one stormy night in a shepherd's hut in Kangaroo Valley. Sleep was difficult for them, and presently they became aware that many kuris had begun to gather in the clearing outside. True to form, our friends were unafraid. In the morning, they learnt that they and the kuris were headed in the same direction, and both parties agreed to travel part of the way together. The Quakers shared their meagre rations in a loaves and fishes apportioning, and the kuris assisted them in negotiating the precipitous Fitzroy escarpment. Backhouse recorded that his companions were travelling a great distance to learn a new song that had just been invented. As an Australian Quaker, I find this encounter hauntingly significant. It occurred quite near the present Quaker-occupied land, Warona, in Jirinja country. It involved kindly friends, as well as those they considered as, quote, having some intellectual potential, was it but rightly cultivated and expanded, unquote. Seeing their companions as spiritually inept rendered the Quakers incapable of appreciating the essential spirituality and integral kinship nature of Aboriginal dependence upon country. Even less could the friends have imagined that the country's integrity depended upon Aboriginal ceremony to keep it strong and healthy in the spirit. And so, as they all travelled north from Kangaroo Valley, Backhouse and Walker were prevented by the culture of their race and era from knowing that only by calling on the deep wisdom of their ancestral spirits did these people have any hope of transcending the horrors of whitefella invasion. That only by weaving the nightmare of continued violation into their spiritual lore, literally by means of enchantment, could their successors and their country have some chance of surviving what was yet to come. As part of the continuing invader culture, I am haunted by what may have become of these people. Who were their law holders? Who were their gifted healers, knowing the secrets of fire and weather, animals and plants, rocks and soil? Who were their wise ones? Were women and children with them? Which other mobs from the west and from the north may these kuris have joined with? And what were the dreaming stories that guided them from birth to death? The full story about these people, this journey and this song remains unknown to us. What is certain, however, is that their spirits and this knowledge are in the land still. I see these Koories walking north towards the Waterloo Creek Massacre in Kamilaroi lands, only 18 months into the future, and towards countless other massacres all over the country and into the 20th century. I see their bodies becoming one with the soil and water of this continent. I feel their spirits inhabiting the rocks and trees and animals, which our Western culture continues to abuse because it cannot bring itself to recognise or respond to the spirit in the more than human world, or respect the experience of those who do. I'd like to turn now to look at how this spiritual insensitivity may impact on our responses as Quakers to the interrelated issues of reconciliation and the environmental crisis. The Quaker silence has not ministered to the current desperate search for a spiritual response to the environmental crisis. Seeking direct knowledge of God in humanity, Friends have instead addressed the here and now of social needs and regarded such action as the strength of our witness for peace and justice. We have also tended to welcome those advances of applied science in the areas of medicine, agriculture, energy, for example, that have seemed to benefit and bring peace to the humanity in which our God is revealed. Yet this anthropocentrism is likely to have retarded our ability to address two major peace issues right here in this country, the current earth crisis and, ironically, Australia's continuing genocidal policies and practices. It is true that the phenomenon of nationwide reconciliation study circles has caused a flourish of interest in the stories of Aboriginal sufferings. We are appalled at our abysmal ignorance of what has been going on, and our hearts break at the tragedy of what we hear. We want to know more about these people whose sufferings were once invisible to us. We want to be reconciled with these people and befriend and help them. But we are often unaware that our very lifestyle, Quakerly though it may be, contributes to their suffering. While some Aboriginal people see their vocation as teaching the white fellow basic spiritual awareness in the hope that one day we may become less barbaric towards them and the earth, most prefer to retire from our burgeoning interest in them. They remember when their body parts were scrutinised by phrenologists and evolutionists, when those who wished to help save them took their children away. More recently, their faith that the anthropologist would explain their cultures to the white fellas in power has been betrayed. Academic and professional reputations have been built on sometimes cold-blooded analyses of Aboriginal living relationships and the information sold to governments, mining firms, and other vested interests for manipulative purposes. We should not be surprised if our sudden interest in them has for them a somewhat familiar ring, or if generally the fascination isn't mutual. After all, their survival depended on spending the past 212 years studying us white fellas in minute detail, our ways of thinking superior and acting superior. As a church, we Quakers may not actively have been responsible for stealing Aboriginal children from their human families, but our unwitting participation in the desecration of country has wrenched Aboriginal peoples from their more than human kin, from all that gave their life its rich meaning and purpose, and allowed the land to wither unsung and uncared for. In this sense, the ecocide in this land is genocide. And as long as we remain insensitive to this, we shall be unaware of the relevance this ecological destruction has to our own spiritual lives. What might be called earth spirituality, with its emphasis on Celtic Christianity and Native American whole earth philosophy, has recently offered to fill the cultural and spiritual void of the displaced Western soul and provide it with a sense of earth belonging. Coincidentally, the reconciliation movement has offered a fresh insight into the culture of Aboriginal peoples. Now that we hear that these peoples are privy to the most ancient spiritual knowledge in the world, we are eager to learn more of their ways and see how we may be enriched by this wisdom. I used to worry that once we white fellows got our hands on Aboriginal spirituality, and we do try, the great theft would be complete. But Aboriginal people have taught me there's little cause for concern, because the pathway to such spiritual depths for us lies through justice. Ever perceptive and desirous for the future of the whole world, that we should change our ways, Aboriginal peoples tell us to stop studying them and start looking at what it is to be a white fella. We are illegal immigrants to this land. We are culturally oblivious to an indigenous spiritual and natural economic system that cherishes every life form. 80% of us choose to live in urban settlements, huddling on our coastlines as if ready for imminent evacuation. And as if to ward off the spectres from the past, our domestic environments are paved over, built up, exotically planted, eternally lit, and incessantly on the move. Here in the city, we feel protected from the earth's feedback. Here we feel safe from the night sky's scrutiny, from the secret whisperings of the bush and the dangers of wilderness. Our excursions into the empty interior, or even to a piece of unknown bushland, are frequently of short, timid duration and tethered by the umbilical cord of a 20th century technology excessive in its use of irreplaceable energy. No matter how dearly we may love the wilderness, the offerings of civilization, or rather urbanism, are what increasingly we feel we cannot live without. Cities nurture us with libraries and good bookshops, live music in the theatre, superior education for our children, and the stimulation of intellectual company, while for our infirmities and to prolong our old age, they ensure the latest in medical technology. For friends, too, cities are where it all happens. If you find this hard to imagine, just ponder for a moment on the inadequacies of our imported structures to address the needs of scattered non-urban friends, or recall the fuss that arises when a country location for a yearly meeting is proposed. We may know about the monocultural crops being weakened and susceptible to diseases, yet fail to see how ailing, how vastly damaging and unsustainable is the monoculture of the urban landscape. However gently we feel we walk upon the bitumen of the city, we may never be aware of the massive pressure our footprints impose upon the earth's life systems. That the soils of this country are salt poisoned and eroded. That our waterways are becoming stagnant and polluted. That this country boasts the world's highest percentage of endangered mammal species. That by the end of this century, one half of Australia's bird species will have vanished. That the frogs, indicators of a healthy environment are disappearing, that our pastoral practices have ruined more than half of all grazing lands, and that agriculture wrecks more than two-thirds of arable lands, that land clearing outstrips our reforestation efforts by 200,000 hectares each year, and that 1,000 hectares of native vegetation are cleared every single day. These are issues which don't yet appear to impact on our lives as corporate Quakers. The integrity of creation is not a frequent topic of after-meeting tea and biscuits conversation or the focus of Quaker basic study circles. We feel that these are subjects for the experts and the scientists who know about these things. But what we do not know about or think about or care about, we cannot pray about or act on behalf of. If we are serious about reconciliation with the earth and its peoples, we shall need to offer more than fine-sounding words. Former Donald Groom Fellow Anne Paddle Gray says that it takes considerably more. We want instead to see serious change take place, not sweet gestures and posturing. When we now consider the plight of all Earth life systems, the parallels between our approaches to Aboriginal justice and to ecological justice is starkly plain. Those who speak for the earth, like Thomas Berry, say we need to reinvent the human at the species level. Nyakina lawkeeper Paddy Rowe tells us that we have to learn to see again, become more alive